And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have music wall-to-wall today on the program. A little later in the hour, we're going to be previewing for you the musical theater production that is about to open at the University of Wisconsin Parkside tonight, the marvelous musical Spring Awakening. I'll be speaking with Rachel Swartz from the theater faculty, who is the director of that production. But we're starting out today's morning show with a preview of something very different that is about to open on the campus of Carthage College, namely the Spring Opera Workshop performance. And this time around, the Opera Workshop presentation is called In Memory of Mozart, a tribute to a singular genius. And with me in the studios for part one of today's program is Katie Ann Nelson, who is a music major at Carthage, an exceptionally talented young woman who has been a part of Opera Workshop on several previous occasions. This will be her last time. But in addition to being a marvelous singer, she's also a really, really fine pianist and clarinetist, and has been a triple threat at Carthage over the last few years that she has been a student there. So we're going to be talking about what's going to be offered up with this Opera Workshop presentation, and also touch on some other aspects of Katie Ann's already long and rich life as a musician. And so lots to talk about over the next few minutes. And Katie Ann Nelson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much. What an introduction. Gosh.
Glad we can have this conversation. I look forward to this very, very much. So first of all, let's kind of talk about your origin story, if we could, and the fact that although you are an exceptionally gifted musician, in some respects it shouldn't be a total surprise given where you come from and who you come from, so to speak. So tell our listeners a little bit about where you grew up, and especially the music-drenched home in which you grew up.
I grew up in Waterford, Wisconsin, which is just 45 minutes, like northwest-ish of here. My parents were both band directors, so my mom was my middle school band director. My dad was my high school band director. I have three older brothers. They're all incredible musicians. My mom was my first clarinet teacher, and yeah, we had music in the sight reading Sundays. That happened. It was a music-filled home for sure.
I'm just curious. I don't know that I would have thought to ask this, except for the way you just kind of phrased it. What was it like for your own mother to be your middle school band director and your dad to be your high school band director? I mean, in many respects, I'm sure it was great. Was it ever not great?
Well, you know, it became really convenient when I forgot to, like, get that permission slip signed. You know, just like, let me run down to 140 real quick.
Yeah.
You know, food in the fridge for lunchtime, that's a perk. It's weird having your mom and dad with you at school all the time. I feel like you've got that extra, like, set of eyes on you, and that like, extra pressure of, oh, like, don't mess up. My dad works here. Like, that's the, oh, no. So pros and cons for sure, but I think it turned out okay.
Absolutely.
All right in the end.
For sure you did. And of course, Waterford has a marvelous music program just overall. And in addition to playing under your dad at Waterford High School, you also sang under the really capable leadership of Derek Mahan. Just talk for a moment about just what a rich experience that was and some of the things that make Mr. Mahan's choral program something really distinctive and special.
Yeah, oh my gosh, there's so much. He's definitely one of those early formative figures for me. I sang in Madrigals, which was this incredible production, and Mr. Mahan was so particular about the way in which we sang all of the languages and the ways in which we presented the story and the show. I did vocal jazz, and Mr. Mahan was an incredible jazz pianist and knew so much about that jazz, the jazz idiom in general. And his choirs were just, amazing. And he had given me so many opportunities to expand my collaborative piano skills. And he'd have me, play warm-ups in the morning for the choir. And, he gave me so many opportunities to sort of explore being a choir member, but also being a collaborative pianist, but also being a little bit of, like, what, sectional leader and this and that. So there's a lot that he helped me to sort of start my path.
That's cool. And one of the things that would be one of my first encounters with your family was that it touches on the fact that Derek Mahan for a long time has believed in commissioning new works, new music. And, I mean, every single year, I'm not sure if that's still going on, but for many, many years, every single year, he would commission some kind of new work to be created, especially for his choral students, and commissioned me to write a requiem. And it was one of your older brothers, a wonderful clarinetist, for whom I was supposed to write a clarinet part. And one of my memories of that is Derek was basically pleased with how the piece was shaping up, but he kept telling me to make the clarinet part harder and harder and harder. He said, you just don't understand how wonderful this young clarinetist is. So anyway, so that turned out to be a completely positive and wonderful experience for me, but it also just underscored what a wonderful opportunity he was giving all of you as young musicians to be experiencing music that was created especially for you and that nobody in the whole rest of the world had ever heard or sung before.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I had any new commission experiences. I don't have any that come to mind, but that's definitely something that I remember. I mean, I always went to the choir concerts growing up, so I remember my brother playing and everything. Mm. It's, yeah, special.
So you had a lot of different choices in terms of where you could have gone to college. And I don't want to turn this into a Carthage College commercial, but but I think it's just kind of interesting, the story of all of the possibilities that stretched before you, someone with you with such uncommon gifts. You could have gone almost anywhere and ultimately chose Carthage for what I think is a really intriguing reason. Tell our listeners about that moment in your life when you had to make that decision and what that decision ultimately came down to.
Sure. It's interesting. I don't think I could have gone anywhere. I really think Carthage was the only place I could have gone, because for me, it was really important that I study piano, voice, and clarinet. And I didn't want to choose. To me, it felt like I was like, oh, don't do clarinet. That's the same as chopping off my arm. Like I didn't want to have to make that choice between my right hand or my left hand.
And, I mean, you did not want to give up any of those three areas of interest for you.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was really important that I find a place that would sort of help me facilitate the ability to do all three things. And the deal was that I would make a choice after my freshman year, and that never happened. I just kept going with all three.
Well, and made it work. I think so in other words, some of these other schools that would have been happy to have you, thrilled to have you, were really, it sounds like, all but insisting mm-hmm. that you specialize, that you had to make a choice that would have been essentially impossible to do what you really wanted to do and felt like you needed to do.
Yeah, the phrase that I heard over and over again was, well, maybe you could do two, but you should really just choose one.
Mm, wow.
Dr. GN said, Eduardo Gassu Novelli, who was the director of choral activities for a long time, and he just left recently, but he said, okay, we'll try to see what we can do. Let's just try and make it work.
Right. And I suppose, you know, the concern is a understandable one that a mistake that a lot of students make is to attempt to do too much or more than they really are capable of doing. And so it is not something to undertake lightly or carelessly. But in your case, of course, you'd given this a great deal of thought and you knew this was something you could do. And of course, ultimately, you have done it. Tell us just a moment about these three different pursuits and how different they are from each other. That is, being a really serious classical singer, being a very serious and dedicated pianist, and a very serious clarinetist. They're all music, of course, but even at a careless glance, they look really, really different from each other. How different do they feel to you?
They feel very different. They all demand different things of me. Singing feels so personal. It's like me. It's my voice, and there's nothing I can do to change it. I can't put on a new reed. I can't like change out the barrel. It's like it feels so personal, and it's much more tied to like how I'm feeling emotionally that day, and like if I have allergies or not, if I have a little cold, you know. So there's that challenge there. And the clarinet is so physical. I use like my entire body, and it takes so much breath and energy and everything to play. And the tongue position is so specific, and it's just a lot of very physical things that are demanded of the clarinet. And on the piano, it's just, I don't know, you're removed from the instrument a little bit more, and there's such a like depth of lineage to the piano in general. And that's just an intimidating thing to sort of see and feel that you're a part of. And there's, you know, just so many incredible pianists at Carthage, too. And that's a cool thing to know that you're, you know, in that community.
Right. Part of a crowded field of wonderful pianists. Mm-hmm. So at any given point in time, do you feel like there's sort of a hierarchy in your mind in terms of the one that means the most to you or to which you're giving more of your soul? Or by and large, are they relatively equal in your affections? Or, I mean, have they been fairly consistently over time?
It has shifted over time, for sure, for me. I mean, at the moment, and I'm sure this is where I feel I've settled, that my voice is the thing that I'm going to do for the rest of my life, and that's where I want to go, and it's what I'm pursuing my master's degree in, and all of those good things. But it's hard not to love what you're doing in the moment, you know? So when I'm playing clarinet, and, you know, I tend to do a lot of 20th century jazz sort of centric things on the clarinet, and it's hard not to love that while you're doing it, you know?
One of the real high points in your time at Carthage came, I think, last year when you had the opportunity to play a large excerpt from a really incredible piece from the Romantic era, a piano concerto by Amy Beach. We're going to listen to just a little bit. I wish it was of you playing. I'll never forget your performance. But ahead of just listening to a little bit of this piece, I wonder if you could just kind of talk about how this opportunity came for you to play the opening of this work with the Carthage Philharmonic and what that experience meant to you.
Sure. So this was part of the concerto competition. And Dr. Mislavsky and I, who's my piano teacher, my much beloved piano teacher, she and I had been talking for like the year prior, just discussing like what we might want to do for concerto competition. And I knew that I wanted to play music written by women. So I had done a lot of research, and then I came across Amy Beach's piano concerto. I listened to Joanne Polk's recording of it, and I loved it, fell in love with it. So we talked about it and started working on it, spent about a year working on it. And then I played it for my junior recital. And then the following semester was the concerto competition auditions. So it was me and a handful of other Carthage students auditioned for the concerto competition, and then they selected the Amy Beach to be the piece that was performed. And it was a really, really interesting process of you know, hearing a recording of an orchestra and then hearing the rehearsal process of an orchestra. Like, those are two different things, different things. So a lot of you know, getting used to following a conductor from a soloistic perspective on the piano versus just being a part of the ensemble. But I mean, it was an amazing opportunity overall, like deeply, deeply meaningful for me to perform this work that's not performed, like largely underperformed, and by a composer who should be more well known than she is, and to feel like I'm part of that heritage of women who are starting to reclaim the history of our existence in music, and particularly in composition. So it was really exciting and really fun for me.
Yeah, and it is such a gorgeous work. And I assume this was the first time you'd played the piano with orchestra?
Yes. Yeah, it was. I had played in high school, I played Rhapsody in Blue with the band.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it was with band accompaniment. But first time with orchestra.
Well, here's just a little bit of this really beautiful work by Amy Beach, her piano concerto. Thank you. Gosh, I hate to take that music down. This is the opening to the Piano Concerto Opus 45 of Amy Beach. And this was just to recall a really memorable moment for Katie Ann Nelson, a music major at Carthage, who, as winner of the concerto competition last year, was able to play this opening movement of the Amy Beach with the Carthage Philharmonic. I know something else that has been a really important part of your experience at Carthage has been singing in the choir, in the Carthage choir, and this year in particular, a kind of a dramatic moment in the Carthage choir's history. You are the choir president under the first year of the brand new director, Dr. Maggie Burke. Tell us, first of all, about kind of the interesting time you've had with the Carthage Choir. I mean, it's been eventful on several different levels, and then in particular, this really exciting newest chapter.
Sure. So I was in the choir my freshman year I started, so this is my fifth year in the choir, and Dr. Garcia Novelli was our director at that point. And first 2 years were great, wonderful. We took a tour to Austria. We went to Spital, won the Spital International choral competition, amazing moment, really, really cool. Went to Iceland, went to Germany, it was a great tour. Came back, second year was great until COVID happened. That was not great. And then we had this really weird year of masking and distancing and everybody trying to do their best and, you know, making music as best we could and just trying our best. And it was good. He made it happen, and I'm so grateful that he did. And then Dr. Gien announced that he was taking a new position at the University of Kansas, and then we sort of weren't sure what was going to happen, and we ended up having this just amazing experience with an interim director of the choir. His name was Rick Biella. One of the coolest experiences I had. I was taking vocal music methods at the time, and he was teaching that class along with Carthage Choir, and that was just amazing. Then Dimitri, our music history professor, took over the choir for the year. Grateful for him for all the work that he did. Then we went to Ireland again with Dr. Gien, which was the best ever. And then now up to our new year, currently we're with Dr. Burke, and I just can't say enough amazing things about her. She's just been unbelievable for the choir, and the way that she fosters like the vocal technique within the choir and the centering everything on this like very careful, very thoughtful listening, and the community that she's built in the choir and all of it. It's just really amazing. We're so grateful that she's here.
Right. Tell our listeners about the tour that Dr. Burke took you on earlier this spring.
Yeah, we went to Washington, D.C. So we stopped in Ohio on the way there, went to Washington, D.C., toured around there for a couple of days, went to a couple of high schools, saw all the sites, and then we came back, stopped in Ohio again, and then came home.
A really, really memorable trip. And, of course, all along the way, we're meeting people that know Dr. Burke very, very well. I mean, it's one of the more amazing things about, among many amazing things about her, is that even at her very young age, she's already has all these incredible connections and so many people all across the country who think so highly of her and, you know, want to collaborate in various ways. And that was sort of a neat thing to experience as well. And I suppose as choir president, it's interesting to kind of wear a mantle of special responsibility.
Yeah. My goal is always to sort of just make sure that the choir feels heard and facilitate communication between the choir and Dr. Burke, although she's so amazing, I don't think my job's necessary, but he feels comfortable enough talking to her on her own. But I mean, anything that Dr. Burke, extra things that she might need me to do, just sort of taking the temperature of the ensemble, that sort of thing, I'm always happy to help out.
Very good. So one more concert remains for the Carthage Choir this spring, I believe.
I think so, yep.
So one of the reasons I wanted you to come here, in addition to just kind of talking about some of these really exciting experiences you've had during your time at Carthage, was also to talk about what will be your last performances with Carthage's Opera Workshop, and that will be this weekend, tomorrow afternoon, and also Sunday evening. Maybe ahead of that, just tell us a little bit about your own connection with opera and how that connection began and how that connection has grown.
Well, that connection really began for me during the pandemic. that was the first time that I really sat down and wanted to watch lots of opera. And part of it was one of my closest friends, London Roysden, who I ended up rooming with, and then she is doing her graduate work in Kansas right now. She and I, as like a way to make sure that we're staying in touch and having time to hang out together, we would watch opera together. That was our like thing that we would do over the pandemic. And then from there, I just kept watching opera, and now it's my new Netflix.
So you've been in several different opera workshop performances, including one during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the very first opera workshop I think you were in was entirely virtual. That mm-hmm. was the spring of 2020, and we ultimately didn't really even end the semester with a full performance, but did everything over Zoom. Then in the spring, you were in the following fall, I think it was, mm-hmm. you were in opera workshop again, but that was something put together that was balcony scenes mm-hmm. in which we could safely sing at a distance from one another and still make things happen. And one or two more times, I think. Now, this will be your last opera workshop this coming weekend. Tell our listeners the format of what's going to happen tomorrow afternoon and Sunday evening.
So tomorrow afternoon and Sunday evening, we gather. I play the role of Constanza, Mozart's wife, and I've asked a handful of my closest friends to come and celebrate the life of Mozart, and we grieve together and we relive some of the moments in his career, of his major operas and his not so major operas too. So everybody is singing an aria, and then we move on to our ensembles.
There you go. So the performances are in the recital hall, free and open to the public, tomorrow afternoon at 3, Sunday evening at 6. Seating is going to be kind of immersive, so our cast of 11 students will be essentially seated right with the audience, so everybody feels like all of them are together, part of this gathering. And then soon you are to graduate. That probably feels kind of amazing after all the time you've been at Carthage, and are on to graduate school. So tell us a little bit about your thought process in terms of what this next chapter should be and the kind of things that you considered and weighed.
Yeah, I've had a really evolving sort of thought process that changed a lot over time. Last summer, I spent the summer with another voice teacher at Carthage, Peg Cleveland, at Interlochen in Michigan. And I worked as a collaborative pianist, and I was taking voice lessons with one of the faculty there, Allison Trainer. And I sort of realized in that span of time that the thing I love more than the other things that I've been doing has been voice. And I haven't really given myself a chance to pursue voice full time and see what would happen there. So after that experience, I came back and I was sort of thinking like, oh, well, how can I make this work? Maybe I do collaborative piano and maybe I do voice with that, or like what, how could I have this happen? And then I just sort of came to the conclusion of like, no, if you want to do voice, then go do voice. So I started looking at programs that I started with programs that had strong collaborative programs and strong voice programs. And then I just narrowed it down to voice programs that I would really be interested in, and auditioned a couple places. And I'm headed to University of Colorado Boulder to study with Abigail Nims.
And is it with anything in particular in mind that you hope will come of that? I mean, do you feel like you have a sense of the trajectory of what you hope you will ultimately be doing?
I mean, I want to sing professionally. I want to go and try my luck at an opera career. And, I love teaching, and I love the pedagogy of things. So I'm sure that that will be a part of my future. But yeah, I want to sing.
It reminds me that actually another experience that you had that I suspect contributed to all of this is the summer that you spent in Kenosha as part of the Kenosha Opera Festival.
Yeah.
That's what it was called. Tell our listeners about that experience and what that meant to you.
Sure. So the Kenosha Opera Festival was this experience I had. I was a collaborative piano fellow, and there were several other of my very close friends who were voice fellows too. And we were part of this opera festival that was founded by a Carthage graduate. His name's Nick Huff, and his wife, Keely, who's a professional opera singer. Well, both of them are. And they wanted to create this festival that would sort of train the young generation in the things that they would need to know if they want to sing professionally. So I was there as a collaborative pianist, but they also gave me lots of vocal opportunities along the way to do. And it was great. It was the first time I had sort of really dipped my toes into opera as a genre and actively really participating in it in a very, very deep way. It was great.
Yeah, wonderful. Really. So the ultimate choice you made is for the University of Colorado Boulder. What do you know about that program and exactly what you're going to be doing there?
I mean, it's an amazing program. I just did my auditions for their fall opera, which is Falstaff. So next week, hopefully, we'll hear back about casting. They do really, really great community outreach things. They have this small opera ensemble of mostly graduate students and artist diploma students who go out into the community and try to share opera with the larger community, which I really like. Yeah, it's an amazing program. I remember going there and hearing some of the students and just like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. Mm. Like these voices, it was the coolest thing. And the city is amazing and the mountains. Oh my gosh, I'm really excited.
Right.
Yeah,
Boulder is an absolutely amazing city and a community artistically so rich in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that should be very, very exciting. So is that likely a two-year program that you'll be there?
It is, yeah. It's a two-year program. I have a position, a TA position, working with first-year voice students, just helping them learn music, making sure that they're prepared for their lessons, and that'll be part of it.
Very good. Well, in the last couple of minutes, I want to give you a chance to talk about maybe a couple of other high points that you have experienced over the last 5 years that you have been a student at Carthage College, things that might stand out as especially meaningful and for which you're really grateful.
Oh, gosh. There's so many. Where do I start? The biggest thing for me, I mean, speaking of gratitude, is just like the faculty at Carthage. I mean, I could just list on and on of, you know, Peg and Allison Hall and Dr. Maslowski and Barbara and my clarinet teacher, Dr. Ripley, and you, of course, Greg, and all these faculty members who have just been so incredible and just supportive and always there for me and always trying to, you know, foster the best in me. And that's, I mean, the thing that I'm the most grateful for. The wind orchestra had gone to Japan my sophomore year. That was an amazing experience. Mm. Totally unlike anything I'd ever done before. First time I had sushi. Amazing. Absolutely recommend. It was just an amazing experience, and just everything that I've done at Carthage as a school, and just the faculty has just been so amazing. And outside of the faculty at Carthage, I mean, I think about my student teaching experience with Polly Amborn, who's just been, oh my gosh, talk about top-notch choir directors, and Stan Bochat at Nash Elementary School, who's just, again, one of the most formative people in my life. It's, I mean, I don't know. I couldn't be more grateful. Mm. Even of these things that I'm not going to be pursuing anymore. Like once I graduate Carthage, that's the end of my clarinet performance career. That's gonna be it for me. And I wouldn't trade it for the world. The things that I've done and learned.
So surely you'll touch a clarinet from time to time.
We'll see.
Gotcha. All right. Well, in the meantime, it's been really fun to help you survey some memorable experiences you've had musically over the last few years, and of course, what also stretches ahead for you. And of course, in the immediate future, these two performances coming up of the Carthage Opera Workshop called In Memory of Mozart, tribute to a singular genius, 11 different arias from 11 different operas by Mozart, some of them all but completely unknown, several ensembles as well, and a chance to experience the beauty of Mozart's operatic music. So 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, Sunday evening at 6 o'clock in the recital hall, admission free. Public is welcome to come and enjoy this. And portraying the widow of Mozart, Constanza Mozart, will be Katie Ann Nelson. Katie Ann, this has been great fun to talk with you. And thank you for getting up bright and early on this Friday morning to be part of the morning show today. It's been a pleasure, and best wishes to you and all that stretches ahead for you.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Part two coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. Here is part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. That is one of the great songs from a marvelous musical called Spring Awakening, which has such a fascinating story at its core. And this show is about to open at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside with performances the next two weekends. And I'm glad that we can spend a few minutes talking about this terrific show with Rachel Swartz, who is directing Parkside's production. Rachel Swartz, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you for having me again, Greg.
Glad we can have this conversation about a great show. Carthage did this a few years ago, and I had a couple of my own voice students in the cast, so I made a special point of going, and I'm so glad I took in this show. It is really terrific. But it's also not Oklahoma. It's a show that really has an intriguing kind of complex story. I wonder if you could just give our listeners a little bit of background about the origins of this show and a little bit about its story.
Absolutely. So the piece originates from Franz Wedekind's play written in the 1890s, which was banned for many years and many different times throughout its original history, then drafted in the early 2000s into a contemporary rock musical by Duncan Sheik, who many of us would know from his 90s tune Barely Breathin', as well as Stephen Sater. The piece has some pretty big themes, as you were mentioning, in its discussion of teenage sexuality, in its discussions of queerness, of major themes in mental health and resulting suicide. It's a heavy piece of theater that is supported by this brilliant and riveting rock score. Much of the dialogue remains present from the 1890s play. There was a clear effort in retaining so much of that storytelling when it was adapted. But when we live in the internal lives of these characters, we then transition into this world of folk and punk rock that that feels completely apropos for the internal life of these teens. So that would be my quick pitch of the musical at this bright and early morning.
Right. I'm glad you touched on the fact that this highly contemporary score somehow is fitting, even though the original story is not a contemporary story. But I suppose part of the point is that this story from well more than a century ago in a sense, feels contemporary, feels young, because of the themes that it tackles, and which it tackles so forthrightly, so openly. And maybe that's one reason why it does not feel jarring in the least to have this modern day music accompanying this older story.
Absolutely. And as I prepped my students for the piece, most of them were very aware of the rock musical and, you know, knew the tunes in it as they were prepping for their audition. But what they were completely floored by was the fact that it did have its 1890s origin. So it's fascinating to me that they felt more confident in it being a piece that was written now about the now and set in the 1890s, which it is, rather than it being a piece from the 1890s that has shockingly and alarmingly still relevant themes. That response was so fascinating to me in how viscerally my students felt that it was relevant and necessary and now.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, although you've just given a hint as to maybe what your answer will be, but tell us about the choice to do this musical. First of all, was this a choice of yours, or is the repertoire for the theatrical season at Parkside chosen in some other way? How is it that Parkside is coming to do Spring Awakening here and now?
Sure. So when we began our season selection, the piece was, I'll get into why it has become increasingly more relevant and hot topic at this moment. But we were in search for a piece that was incredibly ensemble driven. I was looking for a rock musical that had a mixed belt score. I was looking for something that had equitable breakdown in a multitude of characters, that had an expandable ensemble, that I could hire a small band for. So there were so many qualifiers that I was looking for. And this was one of two pieces that checked all the boxes. And so I brought both of those pieces to my faculty and colleagues. And as soon as I said Spring Awakening, my colleagues went, absolutely. So that was somewhat of the resolved process in that. Now, as soon as I selected this piece, which I will caution listeners that enjoy musical theater, as you said, it's not your Oklahoma. Though I would counter, it's as we think about the history of contemporary musicals and the edginess and the hot topic issues that they discuss, that Rodgers and Hammerstein were doing no different when they made Carousel that talks about domestic violence, when they were portraying what is frontier justice in Oklahoma. So sometimes Oklahoma, we forget how edgy those pieces are.
That's a really good point. Yes, absolutely.
Musical theater has since its origination and since, you know, one of the first great big American musicals of Showboat has examined issues of our politics and law and our society and asked really potent and challenging questions. And that's one of the things that really deeply draws me to the art form. So sure, it is no Oklahoma, but also it kind of is in that way.
Right.
In that we ask those really challenging works. To address why it's become more hyper-relevant, regardless of one's feelings or where one lies in the issues, this is a piece that does involve a topic of abortion that is discussed, and I know that is a word that draws deep feelings for many, many folks. Shortly after we announced our season, then, of course, the repeal of Roe v. Wade occurred, and that made the show all the more pressing in this particular moment in time.
Right. I want to play just a few moments from what is arguably the best known song from the score, and that is Mama Who Bore Me. I think it comes very early in the show, or at least I know this well because I've played it any number of times for various singers, and it's a hauntingly beautiful piece. Briefly, give us some sense of context. Who is singing this song and why?
Sure. So the piece if we're looking at the solo version, because immediately it follows with a with an all-women's ensemble reprise, Wendla, who's the primary character, the one of the two protagonists of the piece, has been delivered the news that her older sister has become a mother for the second time that afternoon, and it is time for she and Wendla and her mom to go meet the baby, and she questions to her mom, I'm an aunt for the second time. And you can't imagine I still believe in the stork. Mm-hmm. And her mom is quick to, to be over-reductive, to provide the, well, I'll tell you when you're older response, which, you know, not to spoil later bits of the show, but it does have some pretty colossal consequences for Wendla of that ignorance, unfortunately. So this is her first expression of the knowledge that there is this larger world that she is entering as a person without having the words, the vocabulary, and all of that stuff to question it, to protect one's own self. So
good. Here's a little bit of this wonderful song, A Mama Who Bore Me, from the musical Spring Awakening. Just an amazing song in so many ways, and just one of a number of notable songs in this musical. We are speaking Friday morning, right on the eve of your opening, and you and your cast and crew are ready to go?
We are. We had our final dress rehearsal last evening. I do want to take a moment, and while this piece is so heavy in some of its moments, it is also deeply hopeful and irreverent and fun in others, that driving rock score, which has been beautifully realized, not only by our music director and our just rockin' band, but really supported by Jessica Baker, who is our lighting designer on this piece. She's outstanding and has really set up this rock concert atmosphere within the context of this story. It's really the work that our MD and our choreographer and the entirety of the design and technical folks at UW Parkside and the guest artists that we've brought from outside to work on this piece have done has been incredible. So I want to acknowledge that massive collaborative effort that has taken to get us here and how stunning it looks. In all of that real-life collaboration.
Fantastic. If people are interested in attending Spring Awakening, what should they do?
They should go to the RITA website, where you can purchase tickets for all of our music and theatrical performances. There's some other great things happening, like our Parkside Range concert, and wind ensemble and community band and choirs and jazz ensembles concerts coming up as well that folks may love to see. So if they go to the RITA website, they'll be able to get tickets for all of those events, including our show, which I do hope they come to see, because it is a marvelous and insightful and beautiful moment of theater.
Rachel Swartz from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, director of this production of the musical Spring Awakening. Rachel Swartz, great to speak with you, and best wishes to you and your cast and crew for Spring Awakening this weekend and the next weekend. We hope all goes well.
Thank you so much, Greg.
This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, two interesting programs on tomorrow, best-selling author Jerry Oppenheimer and his book Toy Monster, The Big Bad World of Mattel, a look at the complicated history of that giant toy manufacturer. On Sunday, Jake Page and the author of a book called Dogs, A Natural History, a look